This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Dan Vesperman is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. From 1993 to 96, when he was the Sun's European correspondent, he traveled extensively in the Balkans, covering the Bosnian War. He was drawn to the mundane details of life in Sarajevo during the siege, how some women always managed to wear the latest shade of lipstick, how civil servants maintain regular hours investigating pre-war insurance claims in the midst of sniper fire and shelling. The images stuck with him and gelled into his first novel, Lie in the Dark. It's a murder mystery which features a homicide detective, Vlado Petric. He investigates the death of a top-level criminal justice official and in the process uncovers a tangled web of mafia profiteering that extends into every level of Sarajevan society, at times influencing the course of the war itself. I asked Dan Vesperman to read from the beginning of Lie in the Dark. In this passage, he describes Vlado Petric's wartime apartment.
Behind him in the small living room and kitchen was all that remained of Vlado's pre-war world. For more than a year and a half, his wife and daughter had been gone, evacuated to Germany. The door to his daughter's room hadn't been opened for weeks, nor had the door to his and his wife's old bedroom. He had gradually drawn his possessions and his existence together, partly because it kept him away from the windows, more exposed to sniper and artillery fire, and partly to conserve the precious light and heat from his illegal gas hookups, which burned fitfully and low under dwindling pressure. But it was also his way of burrowing in for the duration, of tending his own weak flame against the forces that could blow it out. In approaching each day, he had developed a keen sense of pace, of constant adjustment. Those who burned too brightly, he knew from watching, never lasted. They were the ones whose passions eventually led them running into free fire zones, screaming either in madness or in a final outpouring of impotent rage. But let your flame turn too low, fail to coax it along, and you ended up at the other extreme, spent and empty. You saw them in doorways or hunched at the back of cafes, greasy-haired, staring vacantly, clothes in tatters. They never stopped retreating, ending up at the bottom of either a bottle or a grave.
Dan Vesperman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Your protagonist, Vlado, is acutely conscious of the irony of his job in the midst of wartime killing. When you were reporting on the war, mm-hmm. during the siege, was it striking how well or poorly the criminal justice system functioned in the midst of the chaos of war?
It was striking to me that it functioned at all. In fact, the first time I went, that was one of the questions I had, was what part of the civil order still functioned in any way? And I went to the courthouse, and the windows there, just like all the other buildings, most of them were blown out, covered with plastic. There was no heat, no electricity. Yet you saw a smattering of legal notices posted on the board, and I began finding some judges, some attorneys to talk to, and sure enough, they were rolling right on with prosecutions of murders. Civil suits were being pressed and won, which surprised me greatly. You would think perhaps that would only happen if some city in America was under siege, but it was happening there as well.
Why do you think they push on with things like civil suits?
I think that normalcy, even of that type, has its own virtue, especially when your world has become so abnormal. Those people tried very hard, most of them anyway, to try to live a normal life, because had they just given in to the abnormality of the situation completely, they would have all gone crazy. Some of them collapsed from this feat of endurance after the war. They had tried so hard to keep an even keel during the war that once the shooting stopped, they sort of began to crumble under the burdens that had developed over their heads all those years. So I think they kept on with these routines because they were comforting for them. I think it helped them live it out.
How far did people press on with the institutions of normal society? Could you, for instance, get a parking ticket in Sarajevo?
You didn't get parking tickets anymore because basically cars were all over the place that had been shot, abandoned for whatever reason, blown to pieces. They did begin towing cars, however. They tried to run the trolley system several times. It was a bit of a silly idea or a foolhardy idea, actually, because it was sort of a moving target on a fixed path that the snipers could easily shoot at. But they kept trying to get it up and running with every ceasefire because that was a very big symbol of normalcy of life. It was a symbol of defiance that they were going to keep trying to run things. But not many of the institutions kept going, except such as the courts, criminal justice. Those were some of the few.
What happens to the homicide rate during wartime or during a siege like this in Sarajevo? Is that something you researched in working on the book? Do people tend to murder each other for the same reasons they always do?
Anecdotally, it went up, according to an attorney I talked to. That's what got me interested in writing the book from the angle of a homicide detective. I had a chat with an attorney there, Jarko Bulic, and he said he was very surprised that the homicide rate did seem to be going up. They didn't keep statistics of it during the war. That part of the civil structure did not keep going. But he said, just based on what he had seen and heard, he was just amazed that it seemed to be increasing. There seemed to be more killings than ever, and they were of all varieties. So I think that flies in the face of what people remember in their reading about London, for instance, which during the Blitz, suicides dropped. People seemed to be a lot saner. And in thinking about it later, I think the great difference was that in London, you sort of had a bombing on schedule. You had bombings at night. The sirens would sound. Then you'd have the all clear. In Sarajevo, you never really had an all clear. It was maybe not as vigorous a bombing as during an evening of the siege, during an evening of the Blitz. But when you'd have it, it would be completely random. It might be 10 shells in an hour. It might be one shell in an hour. It might be 50 shells in an hour. It would come and go with no apparent rhyme or reason. And so you never really knew when you were in danger. And as a result, something in the back of your mind told you that you were in danger all of the time.
I'm interested in this idea of people pacing themselves through through a period like this. What were the characteristics that you observed that revealed how people paced themselves through the siege? How did they manifest that, I guess, that kind of emotional or psychological dulling?
I think one of the clearest signs was the women you would see in the street would very much maintain their daily rituals of makeup, of dressing as neatly as possible, even if they were no longer going to jobs but were going to just the market, the bread line, the water line. You saw an astonishing number of people who you would think in a situation like this that people would be so busy trying to survive and get heat and water and food that they would just maybe let everything else go to seed, but they didn't. And you would see people in the street just very obviously trying to maintain just the way they looked, the way they went about their lives every day. They tried to do it with as much semblance of their earlier routines as they could. I think that's how you saw it most.
In one scene, you describe people crossing Sniper's Alley, which is a facet of this Sarajevo war that people heard a lot about. Mm-hmm. And you write that how people crossed it told a lot about their mental state. Mm-hmm. Was there an accepted strategy or an etiquette to avoid sniper fire?
The longer the war went on, that etiquette sort of fell to pieces for a lot of people. Early, when the shooting was heavier, people ran. You had to run. Some people didn't cross at all. Later, when the shooting became more sporadic, you had this sense that the snipers were sort of watching and had reached a point where they were growing a little bit lazy, perhaps a little low on ammunition. And the etiquette that developed then was, among some people, a sort of I dare you to shoot me attitude. These were people that you felt like the war was probably getting to more. They would stroll with a studied casualness across the street as if nothing had ever gone wrong here. And you would see other people looking at them, sort of shaking their head. Other people would continue to run. Some people occasionally would just stand in the middle of a fire zone and almost invite it. And the snipers, on the other hand, at times seemed to have a code of their own, where if you're going to pay them some respect and run, or even if it's sort of a half-hearted trot, they're probably not going to waste their energy or their ammunition. At other times, you got a sense that if they saw someone who was paying them no respect at all and just daring them to shoot, well, maybe they would shoot. Maybe they wouldn't. But it was an odd sort of phenomenon.
How did people react when someone did get hit?
Just as they would anywhere at any time. Once someone was hit, it would change everything. It would be a pretty horrifying moment. People would scatter. They didn't want to be the next one to be hit. Gradually, someone would have the courage to if it was a particularly open area, to get back in and try to pull them away or to check it to see if they were alive. It was the same sort of horror and surprise and awfulness that you'd see at any sort of shooting. When that happened, there was no more of any sort of pose.
My guest is Dan Fesperman. His new crime novel, Lie in the Dark, is set in Sarajevo during the Bosnian Civil War. Fesperman is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun and wrote about the war while covering Europe from the Sun's Berlin Bureau. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking with Dan Fesperman. His new crime novel, Lie in the Dark, is set in Sarajevo during the Bosnian Civil War. Your plot involves smuggling of cultural treasures, and mm-hmm. I don't want to give away too mm-hmm. much. Was that idea based on the reporting you did in Bosnia?
It was based on some conversations I'd had with some friends in Belgrade who were talking about the art moving around during and after World War II and how some of it had become, they thought, endangered during this war. And also based on I had done some reporting about looting of cultural treasures in different parts of Bosnia. There was a report, never verified, but from a pretty reliable person in the, I think, the Council of Europe's art recovery effort or art protection effort of, I forget if it was, I think it was a Bosnian Croat unit, a small unit that was going around a captured town in western Herzegovina. Going around in a village from prosperous home to prosperous home with an art appraiser in tow. Some of this also had an aspect of whether, particularly when they were destroying religious icons, of just cultural homicide. They were trying to wipe out the culture of the ethnicity that they were trying to wipe out. They figured if they could wipe out their archives and their artwork and their places of worship and the icons hanging inside, then they could go a long way toward destroying their identity.
I'm curious how different writing about this war in fiction is for you from reporting. Mm-hmm. Did you find that the writing was calling up impressions of the city and impressions of the people that mm-hmm. you weren't really aware of while you were reporting?
Sometimes I think that would happen. I think what it called up more, which I perhaps wasn't as aware of at the time, was just I would try to put myself a lot more into the state of mind of someone who was living through this day after day after day. And I found that in trying to insert myself into that, I saw things differently. I reacted to things differently as I thought about them. I think that's what it did for me.
Can you give an example?
I think there's a scene in the book where I'm describing Vlado walking by a pickup basketball game. And a shell sort of whistles in, and as it turns out, it lands maybe two blocks away. And if you're new there, you react to it. You sort of are not at all concerned about visibly showing that you're tensing up. You almost go into a crouch. You look up. Your eyes go wide. People there, at first, I thought it was nonchalance because they were so used to it. And then as I paid more careful attention, and as I began writing this book, and I was back there at other times, I would notice in a different way, sort of looking at it from their point of view, the way that they were paying attention to it, but they had become very good at sort of acting like they weren't really. And they also were so attuned to the sounds and how far away that minute might be that you would only see the briefest little flinch when the explosion would go off, if it was far enough away, say two blocks, three blocks. And then they would just go right back into what they were doing. And unless you were looking for it, you probably weren't going to see it. And if you were new there, you probably would miss it completely because you'd be so busy just sort of being ready to get out of the way yourself.
Did you wear a flak jacket as a journalist?
I did. There were some people there who sort of made it a point after a while not to. I think they saw that as a measure of being in solidarity with the people there. And they also said, well, you could still get shot in the head, but I figured why I don't think I was ever there. If I'd been there month after month at one time, I think I maybe would have gotten into that mindset too, but I don't think it was a particularly healthy state of mind to be in, to think, well, I'm not going to wear a flak jacket. What good can it do me? And it's not fair. And it's not fair. Everybody should have had one, but everybody didn't. And if you had one, I think you were foolish not to take the precaution, because As a journalist, you put yourself out into the open perhaps a bit more than you would have had to had you lived there full time.
Did you have to struggle at all with the idea of writing a suspense novel,
mm-hmm.
which this, I suppose, is about Sarajevo, instead of some sensitive psychological mm-hmm. drama?
I don't think I ever did. I felt like it was a setting that lent itself to this. I guess what I did not struggle with, but what it did give me a qualm every now and then was the aspect of, gee, I'm going to write a novel about these people, and I'm going to use their, I'm going to turn their horrible situation into what I think is a great setting. And you get this qualm inside, and you think, well, that's, how kosher is that? And then you, but if you think about it, people have written novels of various degrees of seriousness about wars since wars have been fought. And that's not to excuse sort of exploiting people's situation to write fiction about them, but I think it's a good way of trying to understand the way people live through these things is to write fiction about them, whether it's suspense fiction, a crime novel, or some deeper psychological novel of relationships during a war. However you want to slice it, if you're writing about it, you hope that you're adding to some understanding, not just about the way these things start and continue, but to how people deal with them day to day.
My guest is reporter and novelist Dan Vesperman. His new book is Lie in the Dark. It's set during the siege in Sarajevo. Have you kept in touch with people you knew in the city?
I did for about a year or two with one fellow in particular who was, he was about 21 when I first went there, and he had a girlfriend in Austria who had left the city, and he worked in the radio room where you made phone calls from and would hear a lot of people's phone conversations out to other parts of the world. That was one of the few places you could call out from. And I stayed in touch with him by letter, and I don't want to mention his name because eventually he wrote me from Austria, and he had gotten out by, he had gone out in a Bosnian army truck, and they'd gone out beyond the lines one day. They'd gone over Mount Igman, one of the few ways you could get out beyond the siege lines, and it was precarious. And he and a friend had decided that if they ever did that, if their unit ever did that, that they would desert, and they did. They jumped out of the back of the truck and in a village and got away, and he made his way out of the country to Austria. And the last I heard from him was a letter about, it must have been about 3 years ago, because it was forwarded, it was about 3 years ago. And he had made it, and that's, I haven't heard from him since because he's moved on to other addresses, but I would love to get back in touch with him.
That's how a lot of men got away.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you heard stories, in fact, about from these guys I hung out with once. They would go up and do their once-a-week duty on the front line and then come back down and spend time with their friends. And they were 18, 19, 20 and had no military experience, no guns, no uniforms. But they would they talked of mass desertions. They talked of 10, 12 people at a time sort of shouting to the other side that they were coming over, and they would get up and run across without guns, and they would be gone, and no one really ever knew what happened to them. But for better or for worse, but that did happen.
Have you been back to Sarajevo?
I've not since after the war. I was last there in 96, and it was already sort of taking on the feel of a colonial outpost in a third world country. It was sort of sad, and just what I've heard from people that have been there since, I think it's become more so sort of a place where the foreign aid workers and the foreign investors pretty much provide all of the good jobs or all of the jobs, and it's almost this colonial economy there where everyone is at the mercy of the benevolent occupiers.
There's a lot of speculation now that refugees are returning to Kosovo about the future stability and the makeup of that region. I understand Sarajevo is now almost 90% Muslim, and mm-hmm. that after the war, most of its Croats left for Croatia, Serbs mm-hmm. went to Serbia. Do you see Sarajevo as a model for what might happen in Kosovo in the next 4 or 5 years, this increased ethnic mm-hmm. division and isolation?
It could be, and particularly in the way that the Serb civilians are dealing with it. In Sarajevo, I think it was more so because not only were they, I guess in Kosovo you have NATO troops coming in, but technically they're still a part of Serbia. So they can take some comfort from that and perhaps hope to ride it out and that in the future it will be more like it was before. In Sarajevo, they knew they were becoming part of this Bosnian nation and, matter of fact, the entity of it, which was the Muslim Croat Federation. They knew there was no turning back, no going back to the old boundaries without some sort of new war. And also the local leaders, as Karadzic and the others, were playing to their worst fears and, in some cases, virtually ordering them to leave the suburbs of Sarajevo that were turned over to the Muslim Croat Federation government. So I think the exodus there was a lot more exaggerated than it will be in Kosovo. You'll have an exodus and are having it in Kosovo, but it's not quite the sense of panic that you had in the Sarajevo Serb suburbs after the war.
Dan Vesperman, thanks very much for talking with me on Fresh Air today.
Thank you.
Dan Vesperman's new novel is Lie in the Dark. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.